save Austria from such a fate, because such an action would mean blood. After the army, my SA and Austrian Legion would move in, and nobody can stop their just revenge, not even I. After these threats, Hitler reminded Schuschnigg, rudely addressing him always by his name instead of by his title, as diplomatic courtesy called for, of Austria's isolation and consequent helplessness. Hitler, don't think for one moment that anybody on earth is going to thwart my decisions. Italy? I see eye to eye with Mussolini. England? England will not move one finger for Austria. And France? France, he said, could have stopped Germany in the Rhineland, and then we would have had to retreat, but now it is too late for France. Finally, Hitler, I give you once more, and for the last time, the opportunity to come to terms, Herr Schuschnigg. Either we find a solution now, or else events will take their course. Think it over, Herr Schuschnigg, think it over well. I can only wait until this afternoon. What exactly were the German Chancellor's terms? Schuschnigg asked. We can discuss that this afternoon, Hitler said. During lunch, Hitler appeared to be, Schuschnigg observed somewhat to his surprise, in excellent spirits. His monologue dwelt on horses and houses. He was going to build the greatest skyscrapers the world had ever seen. The Americans will see, he remarked to Schuschnigg, that Germany is building bigger and better buildings than the United States. As for the harried Austrian chancellor, Papen noted that he appeared worried and preoccupied. A chain cigarette smoker, he had not been allowed to smoke in Hitler's presence. But after coffee in an adjoining room, Hitler excused himself, and Schuschnigg was able for the first time to snatch a smoke. He was also able to tell his foreign undersecretary, Guido Schmidt, the bad news. It was soon to grow worse. After cooling their heels for 2 hours in a small anteroom, the two Austrians were ushered into the presence of Ribbentrop, the new German foreign minister, and of Papen. Ribbentrop presented them with a 2-page typewritten draft of an agreement, and remarked that they were Hitler's final demands, and that the Führer would not permit discussion of them. They must be signed forthwith. Schuschnigg says he felt relieved to have at least something definite from Hitler, but as he perused the document, his relief evaporated. For here was a German ultimatum calling on him, in effect, to turn the Austrian government over to the Nazis within 1 week. The ban against the Austrian Nazi Party was to be lifted. All Nazis in jail were to be amnestied, and the pro-Nazi Viennese lawyer Dr. Seyss-Inquart was to be made Minister of the Interior, with authority over the police and security. Another pro-Nazi, Gleiser Horstenau, was to be appointed Minister of War, and the Austrian and German armies were to establish closer relations by a number of measures, including the systematic exchange of 100 officers. Preparations will be made, the final demand read, for the assimilation of the Austrian into the German economic system. For this purpose, Dr. Fischberg, a pro-Nazi, will be appointed Minister of Finance. Schuschnigg, as he later wrote, realized at once that to accept the ultimatum would mean the end of Austria's independence. Ribbentrop advised me to accept the demands at once. I protested and referred him to my previous agreement with von Papen, made prior to coming to Berchtesgaden, and made clear to Ribbentrop that I was not prepared to be confronted with such unreasonable demands. But was Schuschnigg prepared to accept them? That he was not prepared to be confronted with them was obvious even to a dullard such as Ribbentrop. The question was, would he sign them? In this difficult and decisive moment, the young Austrian chancellor began to weaken. He inquired lamely, according to his own account, whether we could count on the goodwill of Germany, whether the Reich government had at least the intention to keep its side of the bargain. He says he received an answer in the affirmative. Then Papen went to work on him. The slippery ambassador admits to his amazement when he read the ultimatum. It was an unwarrantable interference in Austrian sovereignty. Schuschnigg says Papen apologized to him and expressed his complete surprise at the terms. Nevertheless, he advised the Austrian chancellor to sign them. He further informed me that I could be assured that Hitler would take care that, if I signed and acceded to these demands, from that time on Germany would remain loyal to this agreement, and that there would be no further difficulties for Austria. Shushnigg, it would appear from the above statements, the last given in an affidavit at Nuremberg, was not only weakening but letting his naivete get the best of him. He had one last chance to make a stand. He was summoned again to Hitler. He found the Führer pacing excitedly up and down in his study. Hitler: Herr Shushnigg, here is the draft of the document. There is nothing to be discussed. I will not change one single iota. You will either sign it as it is and fulfill my demands within 3 days, or I will order the march into Austria. Shushnigg capitulated. He told Hitler he was willing to sign, but he reminded him that under the Austrian constitution, only the President of the Republic had the legal power to accept such an agreement and carry it out. Therefore, while he was willing to appeal to the President to accept it, he could give no guarantee. "You have to guarantee it," Hitler shouted. "I could not possibly, Herr Reichskanzler," Shushnigg says he replied. At this answer, Shushnigg later recounted, Hitler seemed to lose his self-control. He ran to the doors, opened them, and shouted, "General Keitel!" Then, turning back to me, he said, "I shall have you called later." This was pure bluff, but the harassed Austrian Chancellor, who had been made aware of the presence of the generals all day, did not perhaps know it. Papen relates that Keitel told later of how Hitler greeted him with a broad grin when he rushed in and asked for orders. "There are no orders," Hitler chuckled. "I just wanted to have you here." But Shushnigg and Dr. Schmidt, waiting outside the Führer's study, were impressed. Schmidt whispered that he would not be surprised if the both of them were arrested within the next 5 minutes. 30 minutes later, Shushnigg was again ushered into the presence of Hitler. "I have decided to change my mind, for the first time in my life," Hitler said. "But I warn you, this is your very last chance. I have given you 3 additional days to carry out the agreement." That was the extent of the German dictator's concessions, and though the wording of the final draft was somewhat softened, the changes, as Shushnigg later testified, were inconsequential. Shushnigg signed. It was Austria's death warrant. The behavior of men under duress differs according to their character and is often puzzling. That Shushnigg, a veteran despite his comparative youth of the rough and tumble of politics which had seen his predecessor murdered by the Nazis, was a brave man, few would doubt. Yet his capitulation to Hitler on February 11, 1938, under the terrible threat of armed attack, has left a residue of unresolved doubts among his fellow countrymen and the observers and historians of this fateful period. Was surrender necessary? Was there no alternative? It would be a rash man who would argue that Britain and France, in view of their subsequent behavior in the face of Hitler's aggressions, might have come to the aid of Austria had Hitler then and there marched in. But up to this moment Hitler had not yet broken across the German borders, nor had he prepared his own people and the world for any such act of wanton aggression. The German army itself was scarcely prepared for a war should France and Britain intervene. In a few weeks Austria, as a result of the Berchtesgaden Agreement, would be softened up by the local Nazis and German machinations to a point where Hitler could take it with much less risk of foreign intervention than on February 11th. Shushnigg himself, as he later wrote, recognized that acceptance of Hitler's terms meant nothing else but the complete end of the independence of the Austrian government. Perhaps he was in a daze from his ordeal. After signing away his country's independence at the point of a gun, he indulged in a strange conversation with Hitler, which he himself later recorded in his book. "Does the Herr Reichskanzler," he asked, "believe that the various crises in the world today can be solved in a peaceful manner?" The Führer answered fatuously that they could, "if my advice were followed," whereupon Shushnigg said, apparently with no sign of sarcasm, "At the moment the state of the world looks rather promising, don't you think?" Such an utterance at such a moment seems incredible, but that is what the beaten Austrian Chancellor says he said. Hitler had one more humiliation to administer to him. When Shushnigg suggested that in the press release of their meeting mention be made that their discussion reaffirmed the July 1936 agreement, Hitler exclaimed, "Oh no! First you have to fulfill the conditions of our agreement. This is what is going to the press. Today the Führer and Reichskanzler conferred with the Austrian Bundeskanzler at the Berghof. That's all." Declining the Führer's invitation to stay for dinner, Schuschnigg and Schmidt drove down from the mountains to Salzburg. It was a gray and foggy winter night. The ubiquitous Papen accompanied them as far as the frontier and was somewhat uncomfortable in what he terms the oppressive silence. He could not refrain from trying to cheer his Austrian friends up. "Well, now," he exclaimed to them, "you have seen what the Führer can be like at times, but the next time I am sure it will be different. You know, the Führer can be absolutely charming." Papen's version, see his memoirs, page 420, is somewhat different, but that of Schuschnigg rings more true. The 4 weeks' agony, February 12th to March 11th, 1938. Hitler had given Schuschnigg 4 days until Tuesday, February 15th, to send him a binding reply that he would carry out the ultimatum, and an additional 3 days until February 18th to fulfill its specific terms. Schuschnigg returned to Vienna on the morning of February 12th and immediately sought out President Miklas. Wilhelm Miklas was a plodding, mediocre man of whom the Viennese said that his chief accomplishment in life had been to father a large brood of children. But there was in him a certain peasant solidity, and in this crisis at the end of 52 years as a state official, he was to display more courage than any other Austrian. He was willing to make certain concessions to Hitler, such as amnestying the Austrian Nazis, but he balked at putting Zeiss Indquart in charge of the police and the army. Papen duly reported this to Berlin on the evening of February 14th. He said Schuschnigg hoped to overcome the resistance of the president by tomorrow. At 7:30 that same evening, Hitler approved orders drawn up by General Keitel to put military pressure on Austria. Spread false but quite credible news, which may lead to the conclusion of military preparations against Austria. As a matter of fact, Schuschnigg had hardly departed from Berchtesgaden when the Führer began shamming military action in order to see that the Austrian Chancellor did as he was told. Jodl jotted it all down in his diary. February 13th. In the afternoon, General Keitel asks Admiral Canaris and myself to come to his apartment. Wilhelm Canaris was head of the Intelligence Bureau, Abwehr, of OKW. He tells us that the Führer's order is that military pressure by shamming military action should be kept up until the 15th. Proposals for these measures are drafted and submitted to the Führer by telephone for approval. February 14th. The effect is quick and strong. In Austria, the impression is created that Germany is undertaking serious military preparations. General Jodl was not exaggerating. Before the threat of armed invasion, President Miklas gave in, and on the last day of grace, February 15th, Schuschnigg formally advised Ambassador von Papen that the Berchtesgaden Agreement would be carried out before February 18th. On February 16th, the Austrian government announced a general amnesty for Nazis, including those convicted in the murder of Dollfuss, and made public the reorganized cabinet, in which Arthur Zeiss Inquart was named Minister of Security. The next day, this Nazi minister hurried off to Berlin to see Hitler and receive his orders. Zeiss Inquart, the first of the Quislings, was a pleasant-mannered, intelligent young Viennese lawyer who since 1918 had been possessed with a burning desire to see Austria joined with Germany. This was a popular notion in the first years after the war. Indeed, on November 12, 1918, the day after the armistice, the Provisional National Assembly in Vienna, which had just overthrown the Habsburg monarchy and proclaimed the Austrian Republic, had tried to effect an Anschluss by affirming that German Austria is a component part of the German Republic. The victorious Allies had not allowed it, and by the time Hitler came to power in 1933, there was no doubt that the majority of Austrians were against their little countries joining with Nazi Germany. But to Zeiss Inquart, as he said at his trial in Nuremberg, the Nazis stood unflinchingly for the Anschluss, and for this reason he gave them his support. He did not join the party and took no part in its rowdy excesses. He played the role rather of a respectable front for the Austrian Nazis, and after the July 1936 agreement, when he was appointed state counselor, he concentrated his efforts, aided by Papen and other German officials and agents, in burrowing from within. Strangely, both Schuschnigg and Miklas seemed to have trusted him almost to the end. Later, Miklas, a devout Catholic, as was Schuschnigg, confessed that he was favorably impressed by the fact that Zeiss was a diligent churchgoer. The man's Catholicism and also the circumstance that he, like Schuschnigg, had served in a Tyrolean Kaiserjäger regiment during the First World War, in which he was severely wounded, seems to have been the basis of the trust which the Austrian chancellor had for him. Schuschnigg, unfortunately, had a fatal inability to judge a man on more substantial grounds. Perhaps he thought he could keep his new Nazi minister in line by simple bribes. He himself tells in his book of the magic effect of $500 on Zeiss Inquart a year before when he threatened to resign as state councillor, and then reconsidered on the receipt of this paltry sum. But Hitler had the bigger prizes to dazzle before the ambitious young lawyer, as Schuschnigg was soon to learn. On February 20th, Hitler made his long-expected speech to the Reichstag, which had been postponed from January 30th because of the Blomberg-Fritsch crisis and his own machinations against Austria. Though he spoke warmly of Schuschnigg's understanding and of his warm-hearted willingness to bring about a closer understanding between Austria and Germany, a piece of humbug which impressed Prime Minister Chamberlain, the Führer issued a warning which, however much lost on London, did not fall upon deaf ears in Vienna and in Prague. Over 10 million Germans live in two of the states adjoining our frontiers. There must be no doubt about one thing. Political separation from the Reich may not lead to deprivation of rights. That is, the general rights of self-determination. It is unbearable for a world power to know there are racial comrades at its side who are constantly being afflicted with the severest suffering for their sympathy or unity with the whole nation, its destiny and its Weltanschauung. To the interests of the German Reich belong the protection of those German peoples who are not in a position to secure along our frontiers their political and spiritual freedom by their own efforts. That was blunt public notice that henceforth Hitler regarded the future of the 7 million Austrians and the 3 million Sudeten Germans in Czechoslovakia as the affair of the Third Reich. Schuschnigg answered Hitler 4 days later, on February 24th, in a speech to the Austrian Bundestag, whose members, like those of the German Reichstag, were handpicked by a one-party dictatorial regime. Though conciliatory toward Germany, Schuschnigg emphasized that Austria had gone to the very limit of concessions, where we must call a halt and say, thus far and no further. Austria, he said, would never voluntarily give up its independence, and he ended with a stirring call. Red, white, red, the Austrian national colors, until we're dead. The expression also rhymes in German. The 24th of February, Schuschnigg wrote after the war, was for me the crucial date. He awaited anxiously the Führer's reaction to his defiant speech. Papen telegraphed to Berlin the next day, advising the Foreign Office that the speech should not be taken too seriously. Schuschnigg, he said, had expressed his rather strong nationalist feelings in order to retrieve his domestic position. There were plots in Vienna to overthrow him because of his concessions at Berchtesgaden. In the meantime, Papen informed Berlin, the work of Zeiss Inquart is proceeding according to plan. The next day, Papen, his long years of devious work in Austria nearing fruition, took formal leave of the Austrian chancellor and set off for Kitzbühel to do some skiing. Hitler's speech of February 20th, which had been broadcast by the Austrian radio network, had set off a series of massive Nazi demonstrations throughout Austria. On February 24th, during the broadcast of Schuschnigg's reply, a wild mob of 20,000 Nazis in Graz had invaded the town square, torn down the loudspeakers, hauled down the Austrian flag, and raised the swastika banner of Germany. With Zeiss Inquart in personal command of the police, no effort was made to curb the Nazi outbreaks. Schuschnigg's government was breaking down. Not only political, but economic chaos was setting in. There were large withdrawals of accounts from the banks, both from abroad and by the local people. Cancellation of orders from uneasy foreign firms poured into Vienna. The foreign tourists, one of the main props of the Austrian economy, were being frightened away. Toscanini cabled from New York that he was cancelling his appearance at the Salzburg Festival, which drew tens of thousands of tourists each summer, because of political developments in Austria. The situation was becoming so desperate that Otto of Habsburg, The exiled youthful pretender to the throne sent a letter from his home in Belgium, and, as Shushnigg later revealed, implored him on his old oath of allegiance as a former officer of the Imperial Army to appoint him as Chancellor if he thought such a step might save Austria. In his desperation, Shushnigg turned to the Austrian workers, whose free trade unions and political party, the Social Democrats, he had kept suppressed after Dollfuss had brutally smashed them in 1934. These people had represented 42% of the Austrian electorate, and if at any time during the past 4 years the Chancellor had been able to see beyond the narrow horizons of his own clerical fascist dictatorship and had enlisted their support for a moderate anti-Nazi democratic coalition, the Nazis, a relatively small minority, could have been easily handled. But Shushnigg had lacked the stature to take such a step. A decent, upright man as a human being, he had become possessed, as had certain others in Europe, with a contempt for Western democracy and a passion for authoritarian one-party rule. Out of the factories and the prisons, from which many of them recently had been released along with the Nazis, the Social Democrats came in a body on March 4th to respond to the Chancellor's call. Despite all that had happened, they said they were ready to help the government defend the nation's independence. All they asked was what the Chancellor had already conceded to the Nazis: the right to have their own political party and preach their own principles. Shushnigg agreed, but it was too late. On March 3rd, the always well-informed General Jodl noted in his diary, "The Austrian question is becoming critical. 100 officers shall be dispatched here. The Führer wants to see them personally. They should not see to it that the Austrian armed forces will fight better against us, but rather that they do not fight at all." At this crucial moment, Shushnigg decided to make one more final desperate move, which he had been mulling over in his mind since the last days of February when the Nazis began to take over in the provinces. He would hold a plebiscite. He would ask the Austrian people whether they were for a free, independent, social, Christian, and united Austria. Ja oder nein? According to the testimony of President Miklas during a trial of an Austrian Nazi in Vienna after the war, the plebiscite was suggested to Shushnigg by France. Papen, in his memoirs, suggests that the French minister in Vienna, Monsieur Pau, a close personal friend of the Chancellor, was the father of the plebiscite idea. He concedes, however, that Shushnigg certainly adopted it on his own responsibility. "I felt that the moment for a clear decision had come," Shushnigg later wrote. "It seemed irresponsible to wait with fettered hands until, in the course of some weeks, we should be gagged as well. The gamble now was for stakes which demanded the ultimate and supreme effort." Shortly after his return from Berchtesgaden, Shushnigg had apprised Mussolini, Austria's protector, of Hitler's threats, and had received an immediate reply from the Duce that Italy's position on Austria remained unchanged. Now, on March 7th, he sent his military attaché in Rome to Mussolini to inform him that, in view of events, he was probably going to have to resort to a plebiscite. The Italian dictator answered that it was a mistake. Sei un errore. He advised Shushnigg to hold to his previous course. Things were improving. An impending relaxation of relations between Rome and London would do much to ease the pressure. It was the last Shushnigg ever heard from Mussolini. On the evening of March 9th, Shushnigg announced in a speech at Innsbruck that a plebiscite would be held in 4 days, on Sunday, March 13th. The unexpected news sent Adolf Hitler into a fit of fury. Jodl's diary entry of March 10th described the initial reaction in Berlin. By surprise and without consulting his ministers, Shushnigg ordered a plebiscite for Sunday, March 13th. "Führer is determined not to tolerate it." The same night, March 9th to 10th, he calls for Göring. General von Reichenau is called back from Cairo Olympic Committee. General von Schobert, commander of the Munich military district on the Austrian border, is ordered to come, as well as Austrian minister Gleiser Horstenau, who is in the Palatinate. Ribbentrop is being detained in London. Neurath takes over the Foreign Office. The next day, Thursday, March 10th, there was a great bustle in Berlin. Hitler had decided on a military occupation of Austria, and there is no doubt that his generals were taken by surprise. If Shushnigg's plebiscite on Sunday were to be prevented by force, the army would have to move into Austria by Saturday, and there were no plans for such a hasty move. Hitler summoned Keitel for 10 a.m., but before hurrying to the Führer, the general conferred with Jodl and General Max von Wieban, chief of the Führungsstab, operations staff of OKW. The resourceful Jodl remembered Special Case Otto, which had been drawn up to counter an attempt to place Otto of Habsburg on the Austrian throne. Since it was the only plan that existed for military action against Austria, Hitler decided it would have to do. "Prepare Case Otto," he ordered. Keitel raced back to OKW headquarters in the Bendlerstrasse to confer with General Beck, chief of the general staff. When he asked for details of the Otto plan, Beck replied, "We have prepared nothing. Nothing has been done, nothing at all." Beck, in turn, was summoned to the Reich Chancellery. Seizing General von Manstein, who was about to leave Berlin to take up a divisional post, he drove with him over to see Hitler, who told them the army must be ready to march into Austria by Saturday. Neither of the generals offered any objection to this proposal for armed aggression. They were merely concerned with the difficulty of improvising military action on such short notice. Manstein, returning to the Bendlerstrasse, set to work to draft the necessary orders, finishing his task within 5 hours at 6 p.m. At 6:30 p.m., according to Jodl's diary, mobilization orders went out to 3 Army Corps and the Air Force. At 2 a.m. the next morning, March 11th, Hitler issued Directive No. 1 for Operation Otto. Such was his haste that he neglected to sign it, and his signature was not obtained until 1 p.m. Top Secret. 1. If other measures prove unsuccessful, I intend to invade Austria with armed forces to establish constitutional conditions and to prevent further outrages against the pro-German population. 2. The whole operation will be directed by myself. 4. The forces of the Army and the Air Force detailed for this operation must be ready for invasion on March 12, 1938, at the latest by 1200 hours. 5. The behavior of the troops must give the impression that we do not want to wage war against our Austrian brothers. Therefore, any provocation is to be avoided. If, however, resistance is offered, it must be broken ruthlessly by force of arms. A few hours later, Jodl issued supplemental top-secret orders on behalf of the Chief of the Supreme Command of the Armed Forces. 1. If Czechoslovakian troops or militia units are encountered in Austria, they are to be regarded as hostile. 2. The Italians are everywhere to be treated as friends, especially as Mussolini has declared himself disinterested in the solution of the Austrian question. Hitler had been worried about Mussolini. On the afternoon of March 10th, as soon as he had decided on military invasion, he had sent off by special plane Prince Philip of Hesse, with a letter to the Duce, dated March 11th, informing him of the action he contemplated, and asking for the Italian dictator's understanding. The letter, a tissue of lies concerning his treatment of Schuschnigg and conditions in Austria, which he assured the Duce were approaching a state of anarchy, began with such a fraudulent argument that Hitler had it omitted when the letter was later published in Germany. The stricken passages were found after the war in the archives of the Italian Foreign Ministry. He stated that Austria and Czechoslovakia were plotting to restore the Habsburgs and preparing to throw the weight of a mass of at least 20 million men against Germany. He then outlined his demands to Schuschnigg, which, he assured Mussolini, were more than moderate, told of Schuschnigg's failure to carry them out, and spoke of the mockery of a so-called plebiscite. "In my responsibility as Führer and Chancellor of the German Reich, and likewise as a son of this soil, I can no longer remain passive in the face of these developments. I am now determined to restore law and order in my homeland, and enable the people to decide their own fate according to their judgment in an unmistakable, clear, and open manner. Whatever the manner may be in which this plebiscite is to be carried out, I now wish solemnly to assure Your Excellency, as the Duce of Fascist Italy, 1. Consider this step only as one of national self-defense, and therefore as an act that any man of character would do in the same way, were he in my position. You too, Excellency, could not act differently if the fate of Italians were at stake. 2. In a critical hour for Italy, I prove to you the steadfastness of my sympathy. Do not doubt that in the future there will be no change in this respect. 3. Whatever the consequences of the coming events may be, I have drawn a definite boundary between Germany and France, and now draw one just as definite between Italy and us. It is the Brenner. Always in friendship, yours, Adolf Hitler. Drawing the frontier at the Brenner was a sop to Mussolini. It meant that Hitler would not be asking for the return of the southern Tyrol, which was taken from Austria and awarded to Italy at Versailles. The collapse of Schuschnigg. Unmindful of the feverish goings-on over the border in the Third Reich, Dr. Schuschnigg went to bed on the evening of March 10th, firmly convinced, as he later testified, that the plebiscite would be a success for Austria, and that the Nazis would present no formidable obstacle. Indeed, that evening Dr. Seyss-Inquart had assured him that he would support the plebiscite, and even broadcast a speech in its favor. In all fairness, it should be pointed out that Schuschnigg's plebiscite was scarcely more free or democratic than those perpetrated by Hitler in Germany. Since there had been no free elections in Austria since 1933, there were no up-to-date polling lists. Only those persons above 24 were eligible to vote. Only 4 days' notice of the plebiscite had been given to the public, so there was no time for campaigning, even if the opposition groups, the Nazis and the Social Democrats, had been free to do so. The Social Democrats undoubtedly would have voted ja, since they regarded Schuschnigg as a lesser evil than Hitler, and moreover had been promised the restoration of political freedom. There is no question that their vote would have given Schuschnigg a victory. At 5:30 on the morning of Friday, March 11th, the Austrian Chancellor was wakened by the ringing of the telephone at his bedside. Dr. Schubel, the Austrian Chief of Police, was speaking. The Germans had closed the border at Salzburg, he said. Rail traffic between the two countries had been halted. German troops were reported concentrating on the Austrian frontier. By 6:15, Schuschnigg was on his way to his office at the Ballhausplatz, but he decided to stop first at St. Stephen's Cathedral. There, in the first dim light of dawn, while early Mass was being read, he sat restlessly in his pew thinking of the ominous message from the chief of police. "I was not quite sure what it meant," he later recalled. "I only knew that it would bring some change." He gazed at the candles burning in front of the image of Our Lady of Perpetual Succor, looked furtively around, and then made the sign of the cross, as countless Viennese had done before this figure in past times of stress. At the Chancellery all was quiet, not even any disturbing dispatches had arrived during the night from Austria's diplomats abroad. He called police headquarters and asked that as a precautionary measure a police cordon be thrown around the inner city and the government buildings. He also convoked his cabinet colleagues. Only Seyss-Inquart failed to show up. Schuschnigg could not locate him anywhere. Actually, the Nazi minister was out at the Vienna airport. Papen, summarily summoned to Berlin the night before, had departed by special plane at 6 a.m., and Zeiss had seen him off. Now the number one Quisling was waiting for the number two. Gleise Horstenau, like Zeiss, a minister in Schuschnigg's cabinet, like him already deep in treason, who was due to arrive from Berlin with Hitler's orders on what they were to do about the plebiscite. The orders were to call it off, and these were duly presented to Schuschnigg by the two gentlemen at 10 a.m., along with the information that Hitler was furious. After several hours of consultations with President Miklas, his cabinet colleagues, and Dr. Schubel, Schuschnigg agreed to cancel the plebiscite. The police chief had reluctantly told him that the police, liberally sprinkled with Nazis who had been restored to their posts in accordance with the Berchtesgaden ultimatum, could no longer be counted on by the government. On the other hand, Schuschnigg felt sure that the army and the militia of the Patriotic Front, the official authoritarian party in Austria, would fight. But at this crucial moment Schuschnigg decided, he says in fact that his mind had long been made up on the matter, that he would not offer resistance to Hitler if it meant spilling German blood. Hitler was quite willing to do this, but Schuschnigg shrank back from the very prospect. At 2 p.m. he called in Seyss-Inquart and told him that he was calling off the plebiscite. The gentle Judas immediately made for the telephone to inform Göring in Berlin. But in the Nazi scheme of things, one concession from a yielding opponent must lead quickly to another. Göring and Hitler then and there began raising the ante. The minute-by-minute account of how this was done, of the threats and the swindles employed, was recorded, ironically enough, by Göring's own Forschungsamt, the Institute for Research, which took down and transcribed 27 telephone conversations from the field marshal's office beginning at 2:45 p.m. on March 11th. The documents were found in the German Air Ministry after the war and constitute an illuminating record of how Austria's fate was settled by telephone from Berlin during the next few critical hours. During Zeiss's first call to Goering at 2:45 p.m., the field marshal told him that Schuschnigg's cancellation of the plebiscite was not enough, and that after talking with Hitler, he would call him back. This he did at 3:05. Schuschnigg, he ordered, must resign, and Zeiss Inquart must be named chancellor within 2 hours. Goering also told Zeiss then to send the telegram to the Führer as agreed upon. This is the first mention of a telegram that was to pop up throughout the frantic events of the next few hours, and which would be used to perpetrate the swindle by which Hitler justified his aggression to the German people and to the foreign offices of the world. Wilhelm Kepler, Hitler's special agent in Austria, arriving in the afternoon from Berlin to take charge in Papen's absence, had shown Zeiss Inquart the text of a telegram he was to send to the Führer. It requested the dispatch of German troops to Austria to put down disorder. In his Nuremberg affidavit, Zeiss declared that he refused to send such a wire since there were no disorders. Kepler, insisting that it would have to be done, hurried to the Austrian Chancellery, where he was brazen enough to set up an emergency office along with Zeiss and Gleise Horstenau. Why Schuschnigg allowed such interlopers and traitors to establish themselves physically in the seat of the Austrian government at this critical hour is incomprehensible, but he did. Later he remembered the Chancellery as looking like a disturbed beehive, with Zeiss Inquart and Gleise Horstenau holding court in one corner, and around them a busy coming and going of strange-looking men. But apparently it never occurred to the courteous but dazed Chancellor to throw them out. He had made up his mind to yield to Hitler's pressure and resign. While still closeted with Zeiss, he had put through a telephone call to Mussolini, but the Duce was not immediately available, and a few minutes later Schuschnigg cancelled the call. To ask for Mussolini's help, he decided, would be a waste of time. Even Austria's pompous protector was deserting her in the hour of need. A few minutes later, when Schuschnigg was trying to talk President Miklas into accepting his resignation, a message came from the Foreign Office. The Italian government declares that it could give no advice under the circumstances, in case such advice should be asked for. President Wilhelm Miklas was not a great man, but he was a stubborn, upright one. He reluctantly accepted Schuschnigg's resignation, but he refused to make Zeiss Inquart his successor. "That is quite impossible," he said. "We will not be coerced." He instructed Schuschnigg to inform the Germans that their ultimatum was refused. This was promptly reported by Zeiss Inquart to Goering at 5:30 p.m. Zeiss Inquart: "The President has accepted the resignation of Schuschnigg. I suggested he entrust the chancellorship to me, but he would like to entrust a man like Ender." Goering: "Well, that won't do. Under no circumstances. The President has to be informed immediately that he has to turn the powers of the Federal Chancellor over to you, and to accept the Cabinet as it was arranged." There was an interruption at this point. Zeiss Inquart put a Dr. Muhlmann, a shadowy Austrian Nazi whom Schuschnigg had noticed lurking in the background at Berchtesgaden and who was a personal friend of Goering, on the line. Muhlmann: "The President still refuses persistently to give his consent. We three National Socialists went to speak to him personally. He would not even let us see him. So far, it looks as if he were not willing to give in." Goering: "Give me Zeiss." To Zeiss: "Now remember the following. You go immediately together with Lieutenant General Muff," the German military attaché, "and tell the President that if the conditions are not accepted immediately, the troops which are already advancing to the frontier will march in tonight along the whole line, and Austria will cease to exist. Tell him there is no time now for any joke. The situation now is that tonight the invasion will begin from all the corners of Austria. The invasion will be stopped and the troops held on the border only if we are informed by 7:30 that Miklas has entrusted you with the federal chancellorship. Then call out the National Socialists all over the country. They should now be in the streets. So remember, a report must be given by 7:30. If Miklas could not understand it in 4 hours, we shall make him understand it now in 4 minutes." but still the resolute president held out. At 6:30, Goering was back on the phone to Kepler and Zeiss-Inquart. Both reported that President Miklas refused to go along with them. Goering: "Well, then Zeiss-Inquart has to dismiss him. Just go upstairs again and tell him plainly that Zeiss will call on the National Socialist Guards, and in 5 minutes the troops will march in on my order." After this order, General Muff and Kepler presented to the president a second military ultimatum, threatening that if he did not yield within an hour, by 7:30, German troops would march into Austria. "I informed the two gentlemen," Miklas testified later, "that I refused the ultimatum, and that Austria alone determines who is to be the head of government." By this time, the Austrian Nazis had gained control of the streets as well as of the chancellery. About 6 that evening, returning from the hospital where my wife was fighting for her life after a difficult childbirth which had ended with a cesarean operation, I had emerged from the subway at the Karlsplatz to find myself engulfed in a shouting, hysterical Nazi mob which was sweeping toward the inner city. These contorted faces I had seen before, at the Nuremberg party rallies. They were yelling, "Sieg Heil! Sieg Heil! Heil Hitler! Heil Hitler! Hang Schuschnigg! Hang Schuschnigg!" The police, whom only a few hours before I had seen disperse a small Nazi group without any trouble, were standing by, grinning. Schuschnigg heard the tramp and the shouts of the mob, and the sounds impressed him. He hurried to the president's office to make a final plea. But, he says, "President Miklas was adamant. He would not appoint a Nazi as Austrian chancellor. On my insistence that he appoint Zeiss-Inquart, he said again, 'You all desert me now, all of you.' But I saw no other possibility than Zeiss-Inquart. With the little hope I had left, I clung to all the promises he had made me. I clung to his personal reputation as a practicing Catholic and an honest man." Schuschnigg clung to his illusions to the last. The fallen chancellor then proposed that he make a farewell broadcast and explain why he had resigned. He says that Miklas agreed, though the president would later dispute it. "It was the most moving broadcast I have ever heard. The microphone was set up some 5 paces from where Dollfuss had been shot to death by the Nazis." "The German government," Schuschnigg said, "today handed to President Miklas an ultimatum with a time limit, ordering him to nominate as chancellor a person designated by the German government, otherwise German troops would invade Austria. I declare before the world that the reports launched in Germany concerning disorders by the workers, the shedding of streams of blood, and the creation of a situation beyond the control of the Austrian government are lies from A to Z. President Miklas has asked me to tell the people of Austria that we have yielded to force, since we are not prepared even in this terrible hour to shed blood. We have decided to order the troops to offer no resistance. So I take leave of the Austrian people with a German word of farewell uttered from the depth of my heart. God protect Austria." In his post-war testimony already referred to, Miklas denied that he asked Schuschnigg to say any such thing, or that he even agreed that the broadcast should be made. Contrary to what the retiring chancellor said, the president was not yet ready to yield to force. "Things have not gone so far that we must capitulate," he says he told Schuschnigg. He had just turned down the second German ultimatum. He was standing firm. But Schuschnigg's broadcast did help to undermine his position and force his hand. As we shall see, the obstinate old president held out for several hours more before capitulating. On March 13th, he refused to sign the Anschluss law, snuffing out Austria's independent existence, which Zeiss-Inquart, at Hitler's insistence, promulgated. Though he surrendered the functions of his office to the Nazi chancellor for as long as he was prevented from carrying them out, he maintained that he never formally resigned as president. "It would have been too cowardly," he later explained to a Vienna court. This did not prevent Zeiss-Inquart from announcing officially on March 13th that the president, upon request of the chancellor, had resigned from his office, and that his affairs were transferred to the chancellor. The chancellor might take leave, but the stubborn president was not yet ready to. Goering learned this when he phoned General Muff shortly after Schuschnigg's broadcast. "The best thing will be if Miklas resigns," Goering told him. "Yes, but he won't," Muff rejoined. "It was very dramatic. I spoke to him almost 15 minutes. He declared that under no circumstances will he yield to force. So? He will not give in to force? Goering could not believe the words. He does not yield to force, the general repeated. So he just wants to be kicked out? Yes, said Muff. He is staying put. Well, with 14 children, Goering laughed, a man has to stay put. Anyway, tell Zeiss to take over. There was still the matter of the telegram which Hitler wanted in order to justify his invasion. The Führer, according to Papen, who had joined him at the Chancellery in Berlin, was now in a state bordering on hysteria. The stubborn Austrian president was fouling up his plans. So was Zeiss Inquart, because of his failure to send the telegram calling on Hitler to send troops into Austria to quell disorder. Exasperated beyond endurance, Hitler flashed the invasion order at 8:45 p.m. on the evening of March 11th. Marked top secret and identified as Directive No. 2 of Operation Otto, it read in part, "The demands of the German ultimatum to the Austrian government have not been fulfilled. To avoid further bloodshed in Austrian cities, the entry of the German armed forces into Austria will commence, according to Directive No. 1, at daybreak of March 12th. I expect the set objectives to be reached by exerting all forces to the full as quickly as possible." Signed, Adolf Hitler. 3 minutes later, at 8:48, Goering was on the phone to Kepler in Vienna. "Listen carefully. The following telegram should be sent here by Zeiss Inquart. Take the notes. The provisional Austrian government, which after the resignation of the Schuschnigg government considers it its task to establish peace and order in Austria, sends to the German government the urgent request to support it in the task and to help it to prevent bloodshed. For this purpose, it asks the German government to send German troops as soon as possible." Kepler assured the field marshal he would show Zeiss Inquart the text of the telegram immediately. "Well," Goering said, "he does not even have to send the telegram. All he needs to do is say, 'Agreed.'" 1 hour later, Kepler called back Berlin. "Tell the field marshal," he said, "that Zeiss Inquart agrees." Actually, Zeiss Inquart tried until long after midnight to get Hitler to call off the German invasion. A German Foreign Office memorandum reveals that at 2:10 a.m. on March 12th, General Muff telephoned Berlin and stated that on the instructions of Chancellor Zeiss Inquart, he was requesting that the alerted troops should remain on, but not cross, the border. Kepler also came on the telephone to support the request. General Muff, a decent man and an officer of the old school, seems to have been embarrassed by his role in Vienna. When he was informed by Berlin that Hitler declined to halt his troops, he replied that he regretted this message. Thus it was that when I passed through Berlin the next day, I found a screaming headline in the Furkischer Beobachter: "German Austria saved from chaos." There were incredible stories hatched up by Goebbels describing red disorders, fighting, shooting, pillaging, in the main streets of Vienna. And there was the text of the telegram issued by DNB, the official German news agency, which said that it had been dispatched by Zeiss Inquart to Hitler the night before. Actually, two copies of the telegram, just as Goering had dictated it, were found in the German Foreign Office archives at the end of the war. Papen later explained how they got there. They were concocted, he says, sometime later by the German Minister of Posts and Telegraph, and deposited in the government files. Hitler had waited anxiously throughout the frenzied afternoon and evening, not only for President Miklas to capitulate, but for some word from Mussolini. The silence of Austria's protector was becoming ominous. At 10:25 p.m., Prince Philip of Hesse called the Chancellery from Rome. Hitler himself grabbed the telephone. Goering's technicians recorded the conversation that followed. "Prince, I've just come back from the Palazzo Venezia. The Duce accepted the whole thing in a very friendly manner. He sends you his regards. Schuschnigg gave him the news. Mussolini said that Austria would be immaterial to him." Hitler was beside himself with relief and joy. Hitler, "Then please tell Mussolini I will never forget him for this." Prince, "Yes, sir." Hitler, "Never, never, never, no matter what happens. I am ready to make a quite different agreement with him." Prince, "Yes, sir, I told him that too." Hitler, "As soon as the Austrian affair has been settled, I shall be ready to go with him through thick and thin, through anything." Prince. Yes, my Führer. Hitler, listen. I shall make any agreement. I am no longer in fear of the terrible position which would have existed militarily in case we had gotten into a conflict. You may tell him that I do thank him from the bottom of my heart. Never, never shall I forget it. Prince. Yes, my Führer. Hitler. I shall never forget him for this, no matter what happens. If he should ever need any help or be in any danger, he can be convinced that I shall stick to him whatever may happen, even if the whole world gangs up on him. Prince. Yes, my Führer. And what stand were Great Britain and France and the League of Nations taking at this critical moment to halt Germany's aggression against a peaceful neighboring country? None. For the moment, France was again without a government. On Thursday, March 10th, Premier Chotin and his cabinet had resigned. All through the crucial day of Friday, March 11th, when Göring was telephoning his ultimatums to Vienna, there was no one in Paris who could act. It was not until the Anschluss had been proclaimed on the 13th that a French government was formed under Léon Blum. And Britain? On February 20th, a week after Schuschnigg had capitulated at Berchtesgaden, Foreign Secretary Anthony Eden had resigned, principally because of his opposition to further appeasement of Mussolini by Prime Minister Chamberlain. He was replaced by Lord Halifax. This change was welcomed in Berlin. So was Chamberlain's statement to the Commons after the Berchtesgaden ultimatum. The German embassy in London reported fully on it in a dispatch to Berlin on March 4th. Chamberlain was quoted as saying that what happened at Berchtesgaden was merely that two statesmen had agreed upon certain measures for the improvement of relations between their two countries. It appeared hardly possible to insist that just because two statesmen had agreed on certain domestic changes in one of two countries, changes desirable in the interest of relations between them, the one country had renounced its independence in favor of the other. On the contrary, the Federal Chancellor's speech of February 24th contained nothing that might convey the impression that the Federal Chancellor, Schuschnigg, himself believed in the surrender of the independence of his country. In view of the fact that the British legation in Vienna, as I myself learned at the time, had provided Chamberlain with the details of Hitler's Berchtesgaden ultimatum to Schuschnigg, this speech, which was made to the Commons on March 2nd, is astounding. In his testimony at Nuremberg, Guido Schmidt swore that both he and Schuschnigg informed the envoys of the big powers of Hitler's ultimatum in detail. Moreover, the Vienna correspondents of the Times and the Daily Telegraph of London, to my knowledge, also telephoned their respective newspapers a full and accurate report. But it was pleasing to Hitler. He knew that he could march into Austria without getting into complications with Britain. On March 9th, Ribbentrop, the new German foreign minister, had arrived in London to wind up his affairs at the embassy, where he had been ambassador. He had long talks with Chamberlain, Halifax, the King, and the Archbishop of Canterbury. His impressions of the British Prime Minister and Foreign Secretary, he reported back to Berlin, were very good. After a long conference with Lord Halifax, Ribbentrop reported directly to Hitler on March 10th as to what Britain would do if the Austrian question cannot be settled peacefully. Basically, he was convinced from his London talks that England will do nothing in regard to Austria. On Friday, March 11th, Ribbentrop was lunching at Downing Street with the Prime Minister and his associates, when a Foreign Office messenger broke in with urgent dispatches for Chamberlain telling of the startling news from Vienna. Only a few minutes before, Chamberlain had asked Ribbentrop to inform the Führer of his sincere wish and firm determination to clear up German-British relations. Now, at the receipt of the sour news from Austria, the statesman adjourned to the Prime Minister's study, where Chamberlain read to the uncomfortable German Foreign Minister two telegrams from the British legation in Vienna telling of Hitler's ultimatum. The discussion, Ribbentrop reported to Hitler, took place in a tense atmosphere, and the usually calm Lord Halifax was more excited than Chamberlain, who outwardly at least appeared calm and cool-headed. Ribbentrop expressed doubts about the truth of the reports, and this seems to have calmed down his British hosts, for our leave-taking, he reported, was entirely amiable, and even Halifax was calm again. Churchill has given an amusing description of this luncheon in The Gathering Storm, pages 271 to 272. Chamberlain's reaction to the dispatches from Vienna was to instruct Ambassador Henderson in Berlin to pen a note to Acting Foreign Minister von Neurath, stating that if the report of the German ultimatum to Austria was correct, His Majesty's government feel bound to register a protest in the strongest terms. But a formal diplomatic protest at this late hour was the least of Hitler's worries. The next day, March 12th, while German troops were streaming into Austria, Neurath returned a contemptuous reply, declaring that Austro-German relations were the exclusive concern of the German people and not of the British government, and repeating the lies that there had been no German ultimatum to Austria and that troops had been dispatched only in answer to urgent appeals from the newly formed Austrian government. He referred the British ambassador to the telegram, already published in the German press. The lies were repeated in a circular telegram dispatched by Baron von Weizsäcker of the Foreign Office, March 12th, to German envoys abroad for information and orientation of your conversations. Weizsäcker stated that Schuschnigg's declaration concerning a German ultimatum was sheer fabrication, and went on to inform his diplomats abroad, "The truth was that the question of sending military forces was first raised in the well-known telegram of the newly formed Austrian government. In view of the imminent danger of civil war, the Reich government decided to comply with this appeal. Thus, the German Foreign Office lied not only to foreign diplomats but to its own. In a long and ineffectual book written after the war, Weizsäcker, like so many other Germans who served Hitler, maintained that he was anti-Nazi all along." Hitler's only serious worry on the evening of March 11th had been over Mussolini's reaction to his aggression. In his testimony at Nuremberg on August 9, 1946, Field Marshal von Manstein emphasized that at the time when Hitler gave us the orders for Austria, his chief worry was not so much that there might be interference on the part of the Western powers, but his only worry was as to how Italy would behave, because it appeared that Italy always sided with Austria and the Habsburgs. But there was some concern in Berlin, too, as to what Czechoslovakia might do. However, the indefatigable Goering quickly cleared this up. Busy though he was at the telephone directing the coup in Vienna, he managed to slip over during the evening to the Haus der Flieger, where he was official host to 1,000 high-ranking officials and diplomats, who were being entertained at a glittering soiree by the orchestra, the singers, and the ballet of the state opera. When the Czech minister in Berlin, Dr. Mastny, arrived at the gala fete, he was immediately taken aside by the bemedaled field marshal, who told him on his word of honor that Czechoslovakia had nothing to fear from Germany, that the entry of the Reich's troops into Austria was nothing more than a family affair, and that Hitler wanted to improve relations with Prague. In return, he asked for assurances that the Czechs would not mobilize. Dr. Mastny left the reception, telephoned to his foreign minister in Prague, and returned to the hall to tell Goering that his country was not mobilizing, and that Czechoslovakia had no intention of trying to interfere with events in Austria. Goering was relieved and repeated his assurances, adding that he was authorized to back them up by Hitler's word, too. It may have been that even the astute Czech president, Eduard Beneš, did not have time to realize that evening that Austria's end meant Czechoslovakia's as well. There were some in Europe that weekend who thought the Czech government was short-sighted, who argued that in view of the disastrous strategic position in which Czechoslovakia would be left by the Nazi occupation of Austria, with German troops surrounding her on three sides, and considering, too, that her intervention to help save Austria might have brought Russia, France, and Britain, as well as the League of Nations, into a conflict with the Third Reich which the Germans were in no condition to meet, the Czechs should have acted on the night of March 11th. But subsequent events, which shortly will be chronicled here, surely demolish any such argument. A little later, when the two big Western democracies and the League had a better opportunity of stopping Hitler, they shrank from it. Anyway, at no time on the eventful day did Schuschnigg make a formal appeal to London, Paris, Prague, or Geneva. Perhaps, as his memoirs indicate, he thought this would be a waste of time. President Miklas, on the other hand, was under the impression, as he later testified, that the Austrian government, which immediately had informed Paris and London of the German ultimatum, was continuing conversations with the French and British governments throughout the afternoon in order to ascertain their frame of mind. When it became clear that their frame of mind was to do nothing more than utter empty protests, President Miklas, a little before midnight, gave in. he appointed Zaisin Quart Chancellor and accepted his list of cabinet ministers. "I was completely abandoned, both at home and abroad," he commented bitterly later. Having issued a grandiose proclamation to the German people in which he justified his aggression with his usual contempt for the truth, and promised that the Austrian people would choose their future in a real plebiscite, Goebbels read it over the German and Austrian radio stations at noon on March 12th, Hitler set off for his native land.